In this week's episode, the Finding Impact podcast gets taken over by David Auerbach of Sanergy, who speaks to his friend and mentor, Andrew Yoon of One Acre Fund.
FindingImpact.com. FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.
Hey everyone, my name is Andy Narricot and this is the podcast for social entrepreneurs using business to solve problems of poverty. So only a quick message from me this week because I'm handing the mic over to David Auerbach to do a podcast takeover this week. Apart from having a break from my angelic voice, I thought it'd be great to create some social entrepreneur conversations. So David will be doing this podcast takeover for the next few weeks and inviting a few of his chosen and select guests onto the show. But in the meantime, if you haven't already, make sure you check out the show notes for David's interview with Andrew Yoon at findingimpact.com/56. There's a ton of practical advice, so you'll find a summary of the topics we cover and some links to anything mentioned in the interview. Okay, let's get straight into it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the podcast takeover with David Auerbach of Sanergy.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is David from Sanergy, and as you all know, I am ghosting for Andy Narricot, who is somewhere on the Darjeeling Express. Today, I am so thrilled that we have Andrew Yoon of the One Acre Fund, who has agreed to come on to the Finding Impact podcast. I've known Andrew for about 8 years now, and the One Acre Fund, which he co-founded, has just been the luminary that we all look up to, at least within Sanergy, for how to run an incredible organization that thinks about impact and scale and sustainability just so well. When Sanergy was an infant, Andrew welcomed us out to his home in Bungoma in Western Kenya, where he does not live anymore, and just showed us the ropes. And it was just so awesome. And now he has agreed to talk to us here. So Andrew, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Awesome. So first question is, please, just a quick introduction on yourself and perhaps more importantly, your path to founding the One Acre Fund.
Cool. I have a very short history. I was a management consultant and I went to business school at Northwestern and then One Acre Fund. And the kind of the starting of One Acre Fund relates a lot to the kind of the opportunity that we see. I was traveling kind of randomly in rural Kenya and I met one farmer who was yielding 2 tons of food on an acre and her family was thriving. And then I met her neighbor who was yielding 4 times less food. And she'd lost a child. Her family was just desperately poor. And so naturally, I just started asking a lot of questions. You know, what was so different about these two farm families? And turns out the difference was really simple. I mean, they both spent thousands of hours every year doing backbreaking labor. It's just that one of them used a little bit of naturally hybrid seed, micro doses of fertilizer, and spaced her seeds properly. And it made an enormous difference in her life. So the idea for One Acre Fund was born to just provide this very simple difference to the 70% of the world's poor that depend on farming as their livelihood.
Yeah, but that seems, I mean, that's a great insight, but what motivated you to just sort of, I mean, you're at management consulting, business school, you know, you could have really done anything. So what motivated you to just go for this?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'd be interested in your thoughts on Sanergy as well. But I think I was entrepreneurially inclined, but you know, didn't really have an idea necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I'd been open to entrepreneurship as well as, you know, conventional employment for a while. And it just sort of struck me, like, I don't know what it was, but this enormous opportunity staring me in the face. I was also in a safe place, you know, like in business school where I had some time to kind of experiment. And mm-hmm. In my case, at least, I experimented with 40 farmers during my second year of business school. Mm-hmm. kind of working together with them, providing them with kind of the basic program model of One Acre Fund today. And I think that experimentation made me feel definite enough to try to pursue this as like a full-time job. I remember you did something similar. I think you started with like two toilets, right?
Yeah, exactly. Two toilets, exactly. No, and we were in business school, Ani Lindsay and I, and you know, I sort of call it Fraidy Cat entrepreneurship because it wasn't really risk when, you know, when I was developing it within graduate school. But then just like you, I mean, you know, the idea around sanitation, I mean, it was just so big. And, you know, I'm really attracted to big ideas. I'm really attracted to systems change. And I just thought that like, man, like I'd be foolish not to make a go of this and see what happens, you know?
Yeah. I like that phrase, Fraidy Cat entrepreneurship. I don't know if that's what you said, but,
that is what I said.
Yeah. Just kind of the opportunity to try things out a little bit before kind of diving headfirst, you know? I don't think anyone, by the way, needs to necessarily go to business school to do that. They can always do that off the side of their desk when they have a job. But yeah, I like that. That kind of level experiment makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I guess I use that word because like, I knew I was going to get an MBA out of that no matter what. And so I knew that I was sort of set as opposed to, you know, some views of or some approaches to entrepreneurship. So.
Totally.
Okay, so cool. So now, okay, so you've launched One Acre Fund. Everybody knows that you guys are just one of the best social enterprises space, but just sort of for everybody, how big are you right now or what are your results to date? And where are you guys headed?
Yeah, it's going really well. We have been growing, we're entering our fifth consecutive year of like 40% annual growth. And we currently have about 7,000 staff people providing services to about 600,000 farm families every year. And by the end of this year, it'll be like 900,000 farm families. So it's growing quickly. It's not just about size, of course, it's about quality of impact. And we're showing that the activities we support, we have 50% improvement in kind of their profitability. And, you know, we think we're pretty cost effective as well. That's how we measure ourselves, is kind of scale, impact, and cost effectiveness. And yeah, but you know, still we're tiny compared to the problem, you know, like, we think that there are about 50 million smallholder households that our model could support, in sub-Saharan Africa alone. And so, as with everyone in this space, we're just constantly thinking about how we can be more ambitious about what we can achieve.
Yeah. I mean, I would actually dispute that. I don't think everyone is as ambitious as that. And you guys, I really appreciate, you know, that you're going to serve nearly a million farming families. So at least 5 million people probably. And you're like dropping the bucket, you know. And I think I see so much social enterprise out there where, you know, people are just too self-congratulatory about where they are. And, you know, and then Sanergy, I mean, you know, we serve 50,000 people a day and we get praise for that. But I'm just like, man, this is a problem that's affecting over 5 billion people, you know, and we have a way of being able to fix this and just having that urge and desire to want to just to keep getting much bigger and being so cognizant of where you really are in the grand scheme of things. It's just really impressive.
Yeah, that's a great comment. Is all of us eventually need to dream a lot more ambitiously. I mean, we've been at this for like 12 years, so it's taken us a while to get here. But, you know, I often think about it in terms of like kind of decades, you know, it's like it takes the first decade just to sort of get to a reasonable level of scale. And then, you know, hopefully in this coming decade, we can, you know, really start to think about our impact at kind of different country levels and things like that. And so, you know, we're all in this for kind of like a sort of marathon pace, hopefully.
Well, yeah. And you guys, I mean, I know you guys talk a lot about, and I think the phrase you use is like, is it work with service, like a life of service? Is that it? Or about people who are joining your company. And I think that's like so important, you know, because I mean, as cool as it is to join you guys, like you guys, you know, this is a multi-generational problem. I mean, in terms of time, in terms of how long it will take to solve it, and having people who want to commit their lives to it is so valuable as an asset to, I imagine, to the One Acre Fund and to Sanergy too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think both our organizations really benefit from just that kind of cohesion around that shared vision about this being sort of a kind of a lifetime fight.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to go back to day one, as it were. I mean, you shared your founding story, and it's really great. And of course, like a lot of what you're doing is like how can you make farmers richer, right? And be able to live healthy, prosperous lives. And you told me recently about one situation that you had where, you know, that urge to want to help farmers as fast as you can came into conflict, as it were. And that was to introduce passion fruit, which was a valuable crop, into your product offerings, along with the standard crops that you offer, such as, you know, the amazing beans and such. And it went pear-shaped. How about that? And could you talk to us a little bit about that decision at the time and why you thought it was like such a great decision? Because I think a lot of social entrepreneurs see a golden path ahead, and it's always much harder than it actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we'd started off by supporting this kind of core staple food, you know, like maize and beans and that kind of thing. And all along comes this like passion fruit thing, which is like all the rage in Kenya at the time. And it's still a great crop to grow for some people. And people are promising these like enormous profitability numbers and things like that. And, you know, I just like dove headfirst into it without really thinking through really carefully, like the consequences. And what I found is that the numbers looked great on paper, but in practice, they just were not, you know, it just didn't play out in the field. So on one hand, farmers weren't getting the impact that they had been promised from all these studies. It's hard to grow something that requires a high degree of skill. So the impact wasn't there. And then operationally, it was extremely complicated to support this really, really high value crop involving, you know, at some point to support just 1,000 farmers. We had like a couple dozen people on our staff just going around and maintaining the fields. And it was just really, really complicated. Oh, I learned a really important lesson there, which is I think everything we do, we trade off impact for operational complexity. Always try to add the most value for the person you're serving while making operations as simple as humanly possible in order to scale. And I think like that sort of returned us, helped more firmly root us in basically our basic business, which is staple food. You know, like 70% of the world's poor engage in, you know, the staple food farming. They spend every day billions of hours doing it. And so if we can make just like a relatively simple, small tweaks to that behavior, then we can unlock a lot of potential impact, hopefully as operationally simply as possible.
And so then, I mean, there must be so much, that pressure never subsides to go faster. But what you're speaking of is like a real discipline. How do you instill that discipline?
Yeah, I think honestly, like a lot of it in our case was just like making a lot of mistakes and not wanting to make that same mistake again. I think in our example, you know, we have this network of farmers that we serve, and there are a million and one different products that we could offer to them. And every day, you know, five people are emailing us about the latest thing that they want to sell through our network.
Mm-hmm. Like organic fertilizer from sanitation.
Great idea. Let's totally do that. So I think, you know, and then we've just learned time and again that you rolling stuff out kind of willy-nilly is just a recipe for disaster. And so we created, in our case, like this very careful trial pipeline where every year we test probably like 100 different products or practices in these like experimental fields. Then like the 36 things that survive that process get tested with 100 farmers each, kind of A versus B fields, that kind of thing. And then the few things that make it through that get tested with 1,000 farmers. You know, there's sort of like an R&D pipeline. And so, you know, making mistakes like that has resulted in our creating kind of more patient systems and processes. And we've realized that, mm-hmm. you know, next year's growth really doesn't matter in terms of like the grand scheme of things. Setting up a solid platform for sustained growth really does matter on the 5 or 10 year time frame. And so anytime we've felt pressure to produce like really high numbers for next year, we've made mistakes. And anytime we take sort of a 3 or 5 year view, we've done a lot better. A lot of our countries plan their research pipelines knowing that they're not going to get anything out of it for the next 3 years, but this particular trial might pay off like 4 years from now.
And it's nice, I mean, 12 years in to be able to do that. But I get the sense that in the beginning, you were also able to bring about that discipline. Like, how did you engage with, I guess, particularly funders or philanthropy to assure them that this was that slow and steady was the right way to go?
Yeah, I think in our experience, at least, it's always good to kind of, what do they say, under-promise, over-deliver. And honestly, I didn't do a good job of that in the first couple of years. I promised the moon and then routinely under-delivered. But I learned time and again, also just from mistakes, that the best thing to do really is to just forecast something that is really realistic to achieve. And then ideally kind of try to destroy that forecast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no. And it's something that we've learned a lot from you on too. Just because, I mean, that pressure to go faster is always there and you're so tempted. And I have to say for Sanergy, I mean, probably the biggest mistake we ever made was when we overpromised on a results-based financing contract. And it just destroyed morale, for a good 6 months. And it was all because we overpromised and underdelivered.
Totally. I do think like you're saying, like in the long run, we got to be really ambitious, but like you're saying in the short run, there's so many things that can happen in our field that for the next year or something like that, it can be very foolish, I think, to forecast something that's like too aggressive.
So moving gears a little bit. So we have the passion fruit, debacle. And then a few years later, though, you guys have started to expand. You're in several countries. I know that a lot of social entrepreneurs get pressured, Sanergy included, to expand all the time. You know, it works so well where you are. Why can't you just take this to every country or every city in Africa? I must get asked that twice a day. And I've been really struck by the way that you all have thought about it. And I know it is similar to, you know, what you're doing with crops, but I'd love to just sort of hear how you as a leadership team think about expansion, and how your thoughts on expansion have evolved over time too.
Totally. Yeah. I'd say by now we have sort of four principal expansion strategies, and they are very deliberately in a certain order. And I'd say our first priority is always supporting existing operations and in a really robust way. So this is a lot of boring stuff like payroll and internal audit and accounting and logistics and financial controls and basically making sure that whatever we're operating feels incredibly stable and could, you know, it could grow more. It has like the support behind it to add a lot of growth in the future. So we are very passionate about really all the boring stuff that, you know, a lot of people aren't interested in. And that's our first and I think most important growth strategy. And we have really amazing people who like would love to talk a year off about kind of like warehouse inventory control, for example. And then,
it's all right.
Yeah. I mean, I could put them on the phone if you want, but, second, I think we call it, kind of like grow in basically. So, making sure that, in the areas that we work already, that we basically serve more customers. So the retail analogy for like, if we were McDonald's, they would call this like same store growth. And so in our existing geographic footprint, how can we serve more people, on the same number of field officers, or, find pockets where we're underpenetrated and add more field officers basically. That's always like the least expensive way to grow in our opinion. And then next we have grow out, which is to expand our geographic footprint within countries, which is more expensive to do, but again, sort of adds up to really long-term growth. And then lastly, new countries. And there, you know, we've just gotten burned so many times on new countries. We pretty much take the same kind of phased approach that we do R&D, where we'll start off with desk research, then a 3-month field visit, and then a small pilot with a few hundred farmers, and then a bigger pilot with 1,000 farmers, et cetera, et cetera. And everything's really careful because a new country is like a huge financial commitment. So, yeah, it's kind of like our how we think about growth.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I love it. I mean, I think when people think of expansion, they think of your fourth thing.
First, yeah.
Right. I got to take this to new countries, especially. And by some people's, not mine, metrics for success, like that's, you know, that is like the definition of success, is that you were able to replicate it somewhere else. And yet, I mean, both one and two are so cost effective and so important. Again, especially in conjunction with the size of the problem that you're trying to tackle. And number three, the grow out is like, you know, stick to your guns. Like you to spend a long time getting to know Kenya or Rwanda, right? And so, you know, and that's really valuable expertise you have. And and it's smart to be able to expand within those countries, even if it's not nearly as sexy as a new country.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, sexiness should be the absolute last factor in growth when you're making your growth plans.
Do you mind talking a little bit about what you've done in Rwanda and how different it is from what you've done in Kenya or what your first country and how you've brought the government in as a partner? I think it's really interesting and something for social entrepreneurs to think a lot about.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a really great partnership with Government of Rwanda. And in this partnership, we do our best to kind of stay behind the scenes and support really the incredible work that they're doing. As one example, they've set up this pretty amazing network of 14,000 volunteer farmer trainers throughout their entire country, reaching at a really small, you know, granular level, lots of like day-to-day household contact. And for several years now, we've been collaborating together with them. You know, an example is we may have some like pictorial training material that we've generated in our program, and we can sort of help to adapt that to that context, to the context of the kind of this farmer promoter program. And lots of little tweaks like that, kind of helping with some of the back end logistics of like how the actual program is run and how to communicate with the different farmer promoters. We even have like some staff sitting at the Ministry of Agriculture that basically report to the ministry. And yeah, I just think it's a great opportunity as a lot of us grow organizations. And we've talked about this and I've learned from you about this, kind of the opportunity not just to serve people directly, but to ideally work with really large and important partners and to collaborate to reach even more people. So this year, I think through collaborations like this, we'll reach like another 1 million households, kind of really in close partnership, primarily with government. And yeah, I mean, these are huge opportunities.
Do you see that as like as the way ahead with other or do you take each country as differently?
Yeah, we sort of, I guess in our case, sort of see them as two sides of the same coin, where I think everything, all of our expertise, I think, generates from our kind of core program and the presence that we have due to that. And so that's our first growth priority. But then increasingly, we are seeing, you know, what are often referred to as kind of system change opportunities. So opportunities to plug into a bigger system and help to affect change. And, yeah, we're definitely banking big on that. By 2020, our kind of our goal is to reach about 1.25 million households through our core program, and then about 3 million a year through these system change programs. Yeah. But the you know system change has smaller impact per person served.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, I mean, in that example, in sort of what you laid out around expansion, what you laid out with picking crops. For farmers to grow. I imagine, just knowing a lot of the One Acre Fund team, there's a lot of strong opinions and powerful arguments that people make on both sides of whatever debate is being had. I'm curious to learn how you as a leader have worked with your team to ensure that everyone does row in the same direction, once those arguments have been had.
Yeah, we especially in our case, we have this sort of shared leadership structure. So really at every level, there's quite a bit of shared leadership. And, you know, at our highest level, we have this general partner group, which is, I'm one of like 18 partners that run the organization. And I think, you know, that could be a recipe for coordination disaster. As you point out, like everyone's got opinions, they're smart and determined and ambitious. And I think what's made it work for us in our case are like some shared kind of cultural touchstones. What, like, most of us live in rural areas, very close to the customer that we serve, and that provides a lot of strategic unity. I mean, we still disagree on stuff, but for the most part, you know, like the most important things, we really do agree. And then we've had the luxury of not hiring too many people externally. Most of the people that are in our leadership team have really risen from, you know, like third job out of college all the way to the top kind of thing. And so that, I think, has really helped a lot with kind of our cohesion as an organization. I think it's very tempting to try to bring in a lot of really fancy external hires at the very beginning, but and some of those people can be very amazing. They're worth hiring. Yeah. But I like this kind of more patient approach myself.
And 18 general partners versus a narrative of that you are one of the co-founders, and that takes, I think, a tremendous amount of humility to be able to say, I need 17 other partners to make this work. How's it been as a process for you, I guess? Yeah.
No, thanks. Yeah, I think, yeah, in our case, we really believe in the importance of ownership, that we think we grow faster when people have clearly defined spheres that they completely own. And so we find the general partner structure, for example, gives a lot of key leaders like super high degree of ownership. And it helps us to grow faster because you don't have to, anytime someone makes a decision, you know, you don't have to like run it up the flagpole and like, you know, you've got this HQ field disconnect and all that stuff. We really give people authority to make decisions. And I think to do that, you really have to give up control, in my opinion. You have to agree on basic principles and trust that someone's going to do the job right. And so that ownership, I think, is really important to us at all levels, not just the general partner group, but country leadership and within country operations. And I believe it's also the only real way to retain really great people. No really great person is going to like having a boss for more than a year or two.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we lost in the beginning some of those hotshot consultant types because we didn't work out a way of getting them the right level of autonomy. You know, and I think that, and they didn't like having a boss for a year, and then they left. And it's something that we've actively tried to work on too. It's like, how do you actually like really build your company from within and build people so that they are the true decision makers? And you know, we get to hang out on the beach occasionally. Okay.
Exactly.
Never. Okay. So fine. So I wanted to get just you to be a little bit prescriptive for our social entrepreneurs on this subject of decision making. Are there, you know, and you've said a lot of really interesting things, but are there two to three pieces of advice that you would have for these early stage social entrepreneurs on how they should think about decision making for their company?
Yeah. I mean, two things that pop immediately to mind just kind of from our conversation are like try and patience. And I think, you know, it goes back to, again, like the founding of Sanergy and the founding of One Acre Fund, for example, this notion of try first. So, you know, you started with two toilets. We started with 40 farmers. Everything we do is stronger if you get a chance to try it first. It relates to our trial, you know, our R&D pipeline where, we try things before rolling them out. And I guess I would say a similar thing to kind of social entrepreneurs that are just getting started is try whatever you think is going to work, you know, and see it break and fail and, you know, adjust it and that kind of thing. And then, you know, patience, like, I think it can often feel, I'm sure you remember in the early days, like, it feels crushing. You know, I distinctly remember, there was one season where we grew, the whole organization was 1,000 farmers, and we only grew to like 1,500 in the next season or something like that. And at the time, it just felt absolutely crushing. Like all my hopes and dreams were invested in these, like, you know, a few thousand farmers. Mm-hmm. And these days, you know, like that's like a rounding error in the farmers that we serve. Yeah. And those people are, no, the individuals are important, but we always got to think about the grand scheme of things in the long run. And
yeah,
rushing to serve another 200 farmers in that year would have been a huge mistake because it would have, you know, not enabled us to serve tens of thousands later. You know, growing before you're ready is really not a good thing. So I think that patience, you know, as a grizzled old man, I would encourage everyone to have that patience.
I'm totally with you. And just for those listening who are then saying, but my funders won't allow me to be, you know, they want me to go faster. It really is up to you as the entrepreneur to have that transparency with them at the beginning about what you plan to do. And I have consistently found when you underpromise, regardless of what the numbers you set are, and then over deliver, everyone is happy.
Yeah.
And as you said, like 1,000 versus 1,200 doesn't really matter. You know, the lessons learned are much more important for the stage that people are at.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing is the stress, right? Like early stage, especially, there's so much stress. And I took on a mantra very early on is it's always a gift to be given a huge problem when you're small. Like, I wish actually that we'd had a lot more problems in our first 5 years, because at that point you can still fix stuff. Yeah. Like once you're at scale, it's so much harder.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I remember when we had a bad year like 3 years ago, and you sat us down and you were just like, you've learned when you're small about what you did wrong. It is so much easier to do that. And of course for us at the time, it felt like we were just like so incompetent, you know? And we really bounced back from that, but it was so reassuring to hear that from you at that time. So thank you.
Yeah, totally. We've had a lot of those moments.
Yeah. All right. Now, finally, Andy always asks us for you to share what books or resources you use that you help or that help you inform your thinking. For example, I love pretty much every document you've ever shared with me: prescriptive, thoughtful, and solving for the right problem. What might you recommend to our listeners?
Yeah. I guess, my meta recommendation would be, I guess personally, I'm not a big reader. And so, like talking to other people in the field, I've always found is just like a really great practice. I probably have like every week an advisory conversation with someone that I'm trying to learn from, and, you know, for example, you and I have exchanged so many different emails about, you know, everything from sales strategy to like basic HR details and stuff like that. But I think I've pressed like the Eunice book, like the really old one, I think Banker for the Poor. I remember distinctly reading that one and thinking it had a great combination of high level strategy, but then also like really low level kind of operational detail.
Yeah.
So I really liked that one.
Great.
Yeah. And yeah.
Cool.
There's a book written about four of our farmers called The Last Hunger Season. It's also a pretty good read, but
yeah,
I guess I'm not a big reader.
Yeah. That is a great book by Roger Terrell, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's excellent. I recommend it for everybody. And just what Andrew was saying, guys, it's really important to use networks to meet people and just share. You know, at Sanergy, like I try once a week to meet with entrepreneurs too, because I remember how much help we got from organizations like One Acre Fund and Kiva when we were really young. And it's something, you know, I think that I see a lot in the social entrepreneurship community is an ethos of people wanting to help each other. And so don't be afraid to reach out to people. Okay. So with that, Andrew, Asante, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts. Really, I learn a million things every time, and you're very generous when you say that you learn a lot back from me. I feel like I am still miles behind, but excited to catch up.
Nonsense.
Okay, Andy here. Just a quick one to say, wasn't that awesome? Such a candid interview. Thanks, David, for doing the honors this week. And of course, to Andrew for sharing so much about your journey and some wisdom for all of the listeners to take action on. So head over to the show notes at findingimpact.com/56 for some actionable and strategic advice and insights I pulled out from the interview. So I've basically done the legwork for you. I've written all of the key juicy points for you. Head on over there and leave your email address while you're at it so you get notified of future episodes. Thanks everyone for listening. That's it. Have a great week.
FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.